The Apostle Peter wrote that Jesus left us an example that we should follow in His steps. Last Lord's Day morning, using the Gospel of Matthew, we watched those steps of Jesus and where they take us. It began with the rivers of baptism, and then they took us into the wilderness of temptation. They took us by the shores of the Sea of Galilee, which were shores of opportunity for the Lord. Unfortunately, they also took Him to the field of criticism, which constantly came His way, and also to the haven of prayer. And as we watched the Lord travel to those places, we thought about the experiences that we have that are parallel to those, and what we can learn from Him that would be helpful to us. This morning, I'd like for us to conclude that journey that Jesus took by thinking again about following in the steps of Jesus. We're using Matthew's account, and if you would open your Bibles to Matthew chapter 21, we're ready now to watch Jesus as He makes His way to Judea and to Jerusalem for the last time. Matthew 21 begins with the triumphal entry into Jerusalem. But this is not a time of triumph for Jesus in the overall sense, at least so far as people are concerned. Quite to the opposite of that, Jesus is marching right into the courts of opposition. He knew it would be that way. The Lord knew what was in store for Him over and over again. He had tried to warn His disciples. And the disciples knew that trouble was ahead. In John's account, when Jesus announced to them that He wanted to go back to Judea, they began to remind Him that, "Lord, last time we were there, they tried to stone You, and You want to go back again?" And finally, when Jesus insisted, Thomas spoke up and said, "Let us go also, that we may die with Him." So they came to Jerusalem. And it began with the triumphant entry and the crowds bowing to Jesus and saying, "Hosanna to His name." But then the Lord began to look around and see what was going on. There were several reasons that there had been such mounting opposition to Jesus. Part of the reason was just the popularity that Jesus had, the success that He had with the crowd. Much of the opposition rose from things that Jesus would say, either claims that He would make about Himself or the things that He taught as being true from God, which often contradicted what was popularly being taught in His day. But sometimes the Lord just openly challenged the Jewish leaders, saying the things they taught or the things that they practiced were just not right, and telling the crowds, "Don't follow that. You do what I tell you to do." And so as Jesus came into this city on this occasion, He observed the money changers in the temple, busy at work, making merchandise of what was supposed to be religious activity. Incensed, the Lord drove them out and overturned their tables. The next day, they came back. Matthew 21, verse 23, when He entered the temple, the chief priests and the elders of the people came to Him while He was teaching and said, "By what authority are You doing these things, and who gave You this authority?" Jesus said to them, "I will also ask you one thing, which, if you will tell me, I will also tell you by what authority I do these things. The baptism of John was from what source? From heaven or from men?" And they began reasoning among themselves, saying, "If we say from heaven, He will say to us, 'Then why did you not believe Him?' But if we say from men, we fear the people, for they all regard John as a prophet." And answering Jesus, they said, "We do not know." He also said to them, "Neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things." I want you to notice two or three things in this account of how Jesus handled the opposition that came His way. In this reading, it is clear that Jesus did not spend much time trying to convince folks who had shown themselves to be dishonest. If someone was not going to be honest with the Lord and honest with the truth, Jesus was going to move on to someone else who was more humble, more open-hearted, and more devoted to God. I note also, as I read through the rest of this chapter and the following chapter, that Jesus, when facing opposition, wisely did not limit Himself to the options or the answers to questions that His enemies proposed. Sometimes the answer was none of the above or none of what they were suggesting. For example, in Matthew 22, they come with a question about whether it's lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not. Kind of an answer, yes or no. Well, neither yes nor no would fully tell the story the way they framed the question. Then the Sadducees came with a story about a woman who had outlived seven husbands. And so in the resurrection, whose husband will she be? Whose wife will she be? And there are seven choices there. And the Lord opted for none of the above. None of that was right. And so as He would address these questions, a lawyer came then with, well, which is the great commandment? The Lord did not limit Himself to one, but He talked about two that were all inclusive, but those two really included all of the commandments. Sometimes people ask or frame questions in a way that's intended to entrap or to not get at the truth. And the Lord would not have any part of that. He insisted on answering in ways that would advance the truth. And I need to learn that and listen to the question and think about the heart that's being reflected in the question and treat it as the Lord would have treated it. And I also notice as the Lord talks to the people on this occasion that He talked to them in simple terms that they could all understand. In fact, Luke's account says that the crowds were hanging on His every word. As I'm dealing with opponents, I need not fear. I dare not back down from what is true. I need to speak plainly, not rudely, but plainly, and stand for truth. That's what Jesus did in the courts of opposition. And after spending the better part of a week in the courts of opposition, Matthew chapter 26, it was time for Jesus to go to the Garden of Decision. Matthew 26, let's read beginning in verse 36. Then Jesus came with them to a place called Gethsemane and said to His disciples, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." And He took with Him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee and began to be grieved, distressed. Then He said to them, "My soul is deeply grieved to the point of death. Remain here and keep watch with Me." And He went a little beyond them and fell on His face and prayed, saying, "My Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from Me. Yet not as I will, but as You will." And He came to the disciples and found them sleeping and said to Peter, "So you men could not keep watch with Me for 1 hour? Keep watching and praying that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." He went again a second time and prayed, saying, "My Father, if this cannot pass away unless I drink it, Your will be done." Again He came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy. And He left them again and went away and prayed a third time, saying the same thing once more. Then He came to the disciples and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? Behold, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hand of sinners. Get up, let us be going. Behold, the one who betrays Me is at hand." It was indeed the hour of decision for Jesus. Would He go through with this humiliating, shameful, and extremely painful ordeal that the next 24 hours held in store for him. He said to the disciples, "You keep watching and praying because the Spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." And when we read that, we think about the weakness that they reflected and their need for strength. But the Lord was needing strength here too. His flesh was feeling the weakness of the impending trouble. What would He do? His choice was made because He chose from the very beginning to do the Father's will. And as much as He would have liked and as much as He prayed that this cup could pass from Him, He nevertheless chose to drink the cup because that was the Father's will. Now, you and I are also going to have to pass through the garden of decision, and we will do that quite frequently. It begins with the decision to follow Jesus or not. What are we going to do with our lives? Are we going to follow in the footsteps of Jesus, or are we going to go in some direction of our own choosing? That's the first primary and most critical choice that we will make in life. But having made that choice, we will frequently come back to this garden where Jesus was. This was the last, strongest temptation that Satan could throw in his way to avoid the ordeal of the cross. And we're going to be tempted too. And every time we're tempted, we are in the garden of decision. What will I do here? Will I do what it is that the Father's will says I should do? Or am I going to do what Jesus says? Now, we can make that a little simpler if we will in our minds predetermine how we're going to handle some situations so when we get in it, we don't have to think about it. We just do what we know we're supposed to do. And we can make it easier if we will avoid some circumstances of temptation. You know, there are just some settings where temptation is a whole lot stronger than it is in other places. And common sense says stay away from those. But given that, we'll have to pass through this valley, through this garden. But there are other choices that we have to make too. Choices of, if I'm going to serve the Lord, what's the best way for me to try to serve the Lord? In what capacity can I use my God-given talents in the very best way? You know, shall I try to be a teacher? Shall I try to be a deacon? Shall I try to be a servant? Shall I try to be a whatever it might be? I think about decisions that come our way and how they would affect our service to the Lord. Well, what about if I take this job? What about if we move to this place? What about if I retire? Those are all decisions that we make, choices that we make, and we need to make them the same way Jesus did. It's not always real clear cut just exactly what we should do in every one of those circumstances. But you know, the first thing that Jesus was asking was, what's the Father's will? What does the Father want me to accomplish in my life? And if we'll start with that and keep that ever before us, then passing through this garden of decision, well, it'll be a little simpler. Things will be a little clearer as to what we need to do. The Lord came out of this garden with a strong resolve. He said to the disciples, "Get up, let us be going. Behold, the one who betrays me is at hand." And from the garden of decision, Jesus proceeded to what should have been the halls of justice, the place where judges convene courts. But for him, it was exactly the opposite. Jesus walked into the halls of injustice. Because that's all He found when He was on trial. One injustice after another. The very circumstances by which He was there were unjust. Think about His arrest. His arrest was brought about by court officials bribing one of His disciples to give away a secret place so they could come and arrest Him without most folks knowing about it, because most folks would have been outraged by this. And so the disciple came and betrayed Him by means of a kiss. And they took Jesus immediately to the court of the high priest, to the house of the high priest, for trial. Verse 59 of Matthew chapter 26 says, the chief priests and the whole council kept trying to obtain false testimony against Jesus so that they might put Him to death. They did not find any, even though false witnesses came forward. But later on, two came forward and said, this man stated, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days. The high priest stood up and said to him, do you not answer? What is it that these men are testifying about you? But Jesus kept silent. And the high priest said to Him, I adjure you by the living God that you tell us whether you are the Christ, the Son of God. Jesus said to him, you've said it yourself. Nevertheless, I tell you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. Then the high priest tore his robes and said, he has blasphemed. What further need do we have of witnesses? Behold, you've now heard the blasphemy. What do you think? They answered, he deserves death. Then they spat in His face and beat Him with their fists. And others slapped Him and said, prophesy to us, you Christ, who is the one who hit you? If ever there was a rigged trial, this was it. The court had already made up his mind before Jesus was even arrested what the outcome of this proceeding would be. According to the research of laws of judicial process in that era, in that place, they violated almost every one of them. By having a capital trial begin immediately, by having it night, by having it all concluded in one day, and on it goes. So you start with judges that have already made up their mind the outcome. They decided they would bring in some witnesses, I guess just to try to make things look good. The text says they brought in false witnesses. In Mark's account, it says that false witnesses testified, and even their testimony was not consistent. Even the made-up stuff about Jesus made no sense. You couldn't make a case out of any of that. And when that all failed, finally the high priest just turned to Jesus and said, will you tell us yourself? Imagine a court in which the process of evidence is to tell the accused, all right, you testify right now what you've done. I adjure you, I command you by the authority of God, I put you under oath, tell us what you've done. And when Jesus simply acknowledged what the high priest had said about the charge against him, that was it. We're finished with the witnesses. We've heard the blasphemy. He's guilty. What do you think? He deserves to die. And that was it. The next day, early in the morning, they convened the whole council, just kind of rubber stamped this decision. They sent him over to Pilate with a lie. They couldn't put him to death, so they sent him to Pilate, the Roman governor, to get Pilate to do that. And the charge against him was an out-and-out lie. They said that this man was an insurrectionist and that he had taught people not to pay taxes to Caesar. We just read that a while ago. Well, we didn't read it, but in the account a little earlier ago. He said, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. It was false and they knew it. And Pilate then tried Jesus on a couple of different occasions, three times, pronounced him innocent, and then gave the order to crucify him. Do you ever complain that something's not fair in your life? Do you ever have a sense that Christianity is not fair? There's some element of it that just doesn't seem quite fair to you. Maybe some requirement of God that seems to you to be requiring more of you than it's requiring of somebody else, or something that's just really hard to do. And that's just not fair. If anybody could have ever said God's plan is not fair, it would have been the very Son of God. The most unfair thing of it all is the very reason He was there to begin with. As Peter writes in 1 Peter chapter 3, He died the just for the unjust. The fair for the unfair. So when I get to feeling sorry for myself because I feel like my load's a little heavier than somebody else, and somebody else not quite shouldering his part of the burden the way he ought to, and I'm getting put upon a little bit, or something's a little hard, I just need to go back and read about Jesus passing through the halls of injustice. And I need to pick it up and step and walk in the footsteps of Jesus. And so Pilate gave the order for His crucifixion. Matthew chapter 27, beginning in verse 27. The soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the praetorium and gathered the whole Roman cohort around Him. They stripped Him and put a scarlet robe on Him. And after twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on His head and a reed in His right hand. And they knelt down before Him and mocked Him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" They spat on Him. They took the reed and began to beat Him on the head. After they had mocked Him, they took the scarlet robe off Him and put His own garments back on Him and led Him away to crucify Him. As they were coming out, they found a man of Cyrene named Simon, whom they pressed into service to bear His cross. When they came to the place called Golgotha, which means place of a skull, they gave Him wine to drink mixed with gall. And after tasting it, He was unwilling to drink. And when they had crucified Him, they divided up His garments among themselves by casting lots. And sitting down, they began to keep watch over Him there. And above His head, they put up the charge against Him, which read, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." At that time, two robbers were crucified with Him, one on the right and one on the left. And those passing by were hurling abuse at Him, wagging their heads and saying, "You who are going to destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself. If you're the Son of God, come down from the cross." In the same way, the chief priests also, along with the scribes and elders, were mocking Him and saying, "He saved others. He cannot save Himself. He's the King of Israel. Let Him come down now from the cross and we will believe in Him. He trusts in God. Let Him rescue Him now if He delights in Him. For He said, 'I'm the Son of God.'" The robbers who had been crucified with Him were also insulting Him with the same words. Now from the sixth hour, darkness fell upon all the land until the ninth hour. About the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, that is, my God, why have you forsaken me? And some of those who were standing there when they heard it began saying, this man's calling for Elijah. Immediately one of them ran, and taking a sponge, he filled it with sour wine and put it on a reed and gave him a drink. But the rest of them said, let us see whether Elijah will come to save him. Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. The Lord passed from the halls of injustice to the hill of sacrifice. And if I ever start thinking in terms of some sacrifice that I have made in service to God, let me humbly go back and read about the Lord's sacrifice that He made for us all. Don't let me ever complain because I have to suffer in some small way, comparatively, for what's right. Let me have the spirit of the disciples who in Acts 5, when they were scourged for preaching after they'd been told to stop preaching, went out rejoicing that they could suffer for His name. The story doesn't end with Jesus on the cross. The story ends with Jesus rising to the mountain of victory. In chapter 28, some women came to the tomb where Jesus had been buried on the third day, the day after the Sabbath, to finish anointing the body. And when they got there, they discovered the tomb was open. The grave was empty. There was an angel there. Verse 5, the angel said, do not be afraid. I know that you're looking for Jesus who's been crucified. He's not here. He's risen, just as He said. Come see the place where He was lying. Go quickly and tell the disciples that He's risen from the dead, and behold, He is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see Him. Behold, I have told you. The angel told them that to go to Galilee, they could find Him. Jesus met some of those along the way. Verse 10, Jesus said to them, do not be afraid. Go and take word to my brethren to leave for Galilee, and there they will see me. And so in verse 16 of Matthew chapter 28, the 11 disciples proceeded to Galilee to the mountain which Jesus had designated. When they saw Him, they worshipped Him. But some were doubtful. And Jesus came up and said, spoke to them, saying, all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Go therefore and make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you. Lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. The story ends on a note of victory. As Jesus, standing on the mountain, announces that He has been given all authority and they are to go make disciples, followers of Jesus, by baptizing them and teaching them to observe all that the Lord commanded. Not too long after that, on another mountain, the Mount of Olives, Jesus victoriously rose back to heaven, ascended back to heaven. You can read about that in Acts chapter 1. Ascended to heaven to sit down at the right hand of God, as Peter announced in Acts chapter 2. On the throne, ruling as the Messiah, just as He said, all authority has been given me in heaven on earth. Jesus' journey ends on the Mount of Victory. And He promises us that that's where our journey will end too, if we follow Him. In Revelation chapter 3 and verse 21, Jesus said, to him who overcomes, I will grant him to sit down with me on my throne as I sat down on my Father's throne. When we walk with Jesus the whole way, He will give us also that same victory that He had, sitting and reigning with Him. Will you follow in the footsteps of Jesus? It begins where Jesus began, the river of baptism. It's an expression of your faith in Jesus who died for you, the just for the unjust. If you will confess that faith, and by that confession express your willingness to follow in the steps of Jesus, to walk as He said, you can be baptized into Him and become His disciple, His follower. Is there someone ready to do that today? If so, come to the front. Let's stand and sing.